I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everybody, and welcome again to the Motorsport Magazine podcast. And today it's a little bit different because we are coming to you from the Black Rock Drivers Club at the Goodwood Festival of Speed. And it's a big weekend here because it's the 20th anniversary, believe it or not, of Lord March's Festival of Speed. But before we get underway, let me tell you about a very special event with Sir Stirling Moss, which is available only to you, the Motorsport Magazine readers and subscribers. This is happening on the 18th of September, which happens to be the day after Stirling Moss's 84th birthday, and it's at the Hurlingham Club in London. It'll be a barbecue in the evening, a three-course dinner barbecue, with drinks all through the evening. And the price for that is £110 to our subscribers, and 118 to our readers who do not subscribe yet. So maybe you should think about taking out a subscription. I certainly would. I mean, a barbecue with Sir Stirling Moss at the Hurlingham Club, three-course dinner and drinks all night, but why wouldn't you want to be there? Anyway, we'll remind you of that at the end of the programme. So, let's get the proceedings underway with our editor-in-chief, Mr. Nigel Roebuck, who's been around motor racing for longer than I want to tell you anyway. Nigel, 20th anniversary of the Festival of Speed, it seems almost unbelievable, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely it does. 20 years. I mean, you say it seems a long time. It does in a way, but in another way, I can never remember a time when there wasn't a Festival of Speed. So, I can clearly remember the very first one. And the straw bales and the spectator protected by a piece of string, and it was just beautifully small and informal, and who knew where it was going to finish up.
Those were the days, old boy, weren't they?
Absolutely, old boy, yes.
Now, you are well known for having a particular passion for Grand Prix racing, and dare I say it, not a huge amount of interest in all forms of racing. Formula One is your thing. So, what do you think it is about the Goodwood Festival of Speed, Nigel, that brings so many? There's 180,000 people here over these 4 days.
Well, yeah, I suppose it's true that you're right, my main passion has always been for Formula One, for Grand Prix racing. But on the other hand, I've also loved sports car racing most of my life, not all of it. I mean, I'm getting my enthusiasm for sports car racing back in a big way these days after a sort of fairly fallow period. But, IndyCar racing, before it was ruined, I used to love that too. I think it's people always, if people have a passion for something, their passion is always strongest, I find, for when they first fell in love with it. And I think that applies, people are like that way, they're that way with racing, they're that way with music, aren't they? So I think the attraction of being able to see the cars again, the cars as they were when, the love affair first started, is very, very powerful. And, no one needs to be told how potent nostalgia is. And if you then throw in the fact that Jensen's here this weekend and Lewis is here, Nico is here, in, you know, almost can last year's Formula One cars, you're closer to them and actually closer to the cars than you will ever be at a Grand Prix. And you can come here and, you know, actually get an autograph, which is out of the question these days at a Grand Prix. So
I was interested. I listened to an interview with Ron Dennis the other day, and he was asked what it was about the Festival of Speed that was so appealing to him and why he brings McLaren here. And his reply was, you just have to be there.
Well, it's true. I can't. There's no better way to put it. You know, if you have a real deep love for motor racing, you know, you can't miss it. And it's also, apart from anything else, you know, these days turned into a family day out as well, hasn't it? So it doesn't surprise me. It's ticket only.
Our first guest is here. Ah,
hi.
The fastest.
Good afternoon. Hello,
Anthony Reid, the fastest man of the Festival of Speed in 2012, and will he be again? Well, I can tell you what, you're going to give it a good try. Welcome, Anthony.
Yeah, no, excited to be here this weekend. Fantastic. I've had my wings clipped this year. The car that I won the event in last year hasn't got an entry for this year, but I'm driving lots of interesting stuff.
You've driven a hell of a lot, haven't you? Because remind me when your career started. I remember well being with you at Thruxton in Formula 3.
Well, I mean, my career more or less started here at Goodwood. I raced for a company called Image Race Cars,
based
in the Super Shell building. And I lived in a caravan next to the Super Shell building for about 3 months. I mean, the great thing, no health and safety in those days. If we wanted to test a car, it could be getting, you know, towards dusk, 6-7 o'clock at night. We'd just push it between the barriers onto the track. No marshal cover, no doctor, no nothing. And we'd just go out and test drive around the circuit.
Like your own Fiorano.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Anthony,
yeah.
Anthony, you're quite well known for being rather a brave man. No holds barred, I think, would sum it up. So tell us about driving the Goodwood Hill. Maybe you could take us from the start line and just give us a real insight into what this piece of road is like at high speed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very exciting course, really challenging. It's got all the elements that tests the skills of a professional driver: technicality, speed, and of course danger. So if you run a lap from the start finish line, the first corner is very easy to overdrive. People turn in too late, lose too much time. But that first corner is absolutely critical for getting the launch, the acceleration through the second corner to get down the straight very quickly. It's got to be clean, accurate, and precise. So that the second corner, if you get good launch out of the first corner, is just a very slight lift using every centimeter of tarmac, and that gives you the velocity going into Malcolm. The thing about Malcolm is, most people think it's a left-hand corner. It's not. It's a right-hand curve, then followed by a left-hand corner. And unless you know that, because you can't see it, it's totally blind on the approach, you can really make a fool of yourself, as you've probably seen in the past. So Malcolm, technically really, really challenging, a little bit dangerous. You have to know exactly what you're doing there. And then, of course, you've got the big challenge of the Flint Wall. Most people make a big S out of it. It's actually a straight line if you're going really quick. And to be honest, I'm not satisfied unless I've taken the wing mirrors off the car at that point on the track.
Which you did last year.
Yes. Not last year. I gave it a little bit more safety margin, but I have taken door mirrors off in the past in the Nissan Primera. Immediately following, as you come up to Carney's seat, that fairly tight right-hander, again blind as on the not on the approach, but the exit is blind on the approach. And then you've got the final corner. You have to be flat there if you've got any chance of winning at all, and that is not an easy corner. The very fast, and in an F1 car I was doing 150 miles an hour as I crossed the finish line. So it's just fantastic. It's just such a thrill to drive this hill. It's great.
Just tell us briefly, Anthony, what else you're up to apart from the Goodwood Festival of Speed, because you're always busy, aren't you? You are a man in demand.
Yes, what I really love about my career is I not only drive the modern GTs for Chevron, this is my third season with Chevron Racing and British GT, but also I do a lot of the classics. I've just returned from the Le Mans 24 Hours where I participated in the Legends race, battling for the lead in a D-type Jaguar that actually won the Le Mans 24 Hours in 1955, Mike Hawthorn's 55 winner. And I do lots of stuff. I'm going to be obviously at the Revival later this year. We've got the Silverstone Classic in a couple of weeks. So lots of variety and interesting stuff. And I love that mix of classics with the modern stuff, which keeps me sharp, you know, and you know, relevant to particularly when I'm working with other drivers.
It's a long way from the caravan at Image race cars at Goodwood, isn't it?
Yes. Life is a little bit more comfortable these days.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Thank you.
You're welcome. Cheers.
And guess who's just sat down? It's Henri Pescarolo, Monsieur Le Mans. And also, of course, many other forms of racing. Tell us why you're here at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, Henri.
First time here was when I had my own team, 2000. I had a Courage C52, and at the end of the season, in the middle of the season, the year after, 2001, I came here for the first time with my car, yeah. That was great. And since that, I came only on the Festival of Speed, and or the Revival, sorry. But it's the first time I'm coming back for the Festival of Speed.
Didn't you drive a Cobra at the Revival?
Yeah, I drove a Cobra, and I beat the English Jaguari, E-Jaguar TP, and that was the first time a Cobra was beating the Jaguar. That was great, and after I drove Ferrari, I drove another Cobra, and every year I was coming, and I love that place, and it's fantastic, yeah.
Let me ask you about next year and sports car racing with Le Mans and Porsche returning. It's about time somebody had a bite at Audi, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite strange, you know, but that happened before between Citroën and Peugeot, you know, in the WRC, which is not so good because if one is winning, the other is losing, you know. So, but anyway, Dr. Fish said you can fight and the best will win, you know, so we will see. But I think Porsche will be a very dangerous car for winning for the, not dangerous as a danger, you know, but it will be really a car to win. And I think even with a diesel engine, with a new regulation for Audi, it will be difficult to beat Porsche, I think, you know, and we will see. But what I hope is, as you know, is better equivalence between different type of engine, because since 7 years they kill us with petrol engine, you know, and we disappear. So now with the new regulation, with the equivalence will be with a certain quantity of energy for each other, you know. So they promise us that the private could come back with good chance, perhaps not to win, but to be not too far away from the works car. So there will be Porsche, Audi, Toyota, and behind now there is nobody, you know. So this year I'm not racing because I had a big problem with my main sponsor. I tried to restart next year with that new regulation. I think for private car it should be better, you know.
I know that a lot of people would like to hear about your driving with Graham Hill. Because the people who listen to us on the Motorsport podcast, many of them remember what we call the great old days. Anyway, tell us a bit about what that was like with a man like Graham coming into the team, and you know, with all everything he'd already achieved. And
that was very strange because I knew Graham, of course. You know, he was world champion. He won Indianapolis. And when they told me at Matra team that I would have Graham as a teammate, I was not so happy because I was not sure he was ready to take any risk in the night, in the rain, in the fog, in the morning. You know, it's a very dangerous race. That was a very dangerous race. I was not sure he was really he wanted really to take those risks. And in fact, we won the race because during the night on the run, Graham has been fantastic, you know, and it was already a legend, you know, and I've been very pleased to win with him, you know.
Must have been one of your great moments, wasn't it?
Yes, that was a great moment because it was the first win for Matra. It was my first win. We were fighting so much since a few years to try to achieve that, you know, and to win with a legend like Graham, you know, that's one of my best souvenirs in the race, you know.
Henri, did you in the end fundamentally like sports car racing more than Formula One, or did you prefer driving a Formula One car to anything else?
In fact, when you are a young driver, what you want is to be world champion. Later on, you think what you want is to have a good Formula One to drive. And I never had a really competitive car. You know, the first year with Matra, I have been third in Monaco Grand Prix. That means I was competitive. The car was not so good. And after that, Matra decided to have Chris Amon as the first driver. Veltroise became second driver. So there was no more car for me. After I have been with Frank Williams, that was fabulous, but he has no money in that time. The car was no competitive. But in the same time, I had the best cars in sport prototype and I was winning very often with very nice cars in the best teams. So at the end I get the image of an endurance racing driver, and it was not possible to find a good Formula One car. So I decided to stop Formula One. Last year I was with a Certis, you know, and I concentrate all my passion and all my efforts on the sport prototype, you know.
Okay, thank you very much, Henri. Merci.
Thank you.
Merci.
Thank you, Henri.
I'm extremely happy to tell you that we have Nelson Piquet with us. Why am I so happy? Well, he was one of my heroes, of course. But more than that, he's back in the Brabham BMW BT52, which has a huge amount of power. And you are on like a farm track, really, aren't you?
Well, it's so disappointing because I drive so bloody slow here. Afraid of all these walls and I think it's more to come here and see all the beautiful cars, see all the old mechanics, and I came with Paul Rocha from BMW. Tomorrow I will see Gordo Mori, and that's the fun of being here. You know, if you ask me if you have fun to drive the car now, it's not fun at all.
I know Nigel has a few questions for you, but I'd just like to ask you one more, which is, what's it like getting back in that car? I mean, does it bring back all those amazing memories? I mean, is it a bit like an old girlfriend or something or not?
Well, luckily it's the car sitting there the way I was driving in an 83. I have 4 kilos more. That's good enough to get. It's still getting the seat, you know. I drove the car yesterday in airfield to test the car, and I nearly faint twice. When I put all the power there, I got my vision get black. I said, Jesus Christ, what I'm doing here? What I'm doing here? You know. But normally we drive good, change the gear quick and everything. You know, it's amazing. 30 years out the car, and not driving this circuit. This very, very. I don't know even where I go left and right. And the first time was a disaster. Yeah.
Actually, Nelson, my memory of you in that car was Kyle Army at the end of the year, the championship decider. But it was in qualifying. And I was watching you remember the Yuksky sweep at Kyle Army? And you threw there in that car on qualifying boost. It was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. I mean, people now have no idea how much horsepower you had in those days.
Yeah, I think Paul Rocha made a fantastic development engine, and we start the season in 82, and it was so difficult to drive in every race. You have a different turbocharger, you have a little bit different intakes, and the thing was getting better and better and better and better all the time. half through the 83, he came with a new tune, which I just said, oh, we're going to win the championship for sure. And in qualifier, I think we have nearly 300 horsepower more than anybody. In the race, we have more, 100, 150 horsepower more than everybody. It was easy to lead in the front, lead for 10 seconds, and start to slow down, start to slow down in the revs, in the boost, and all the things. Was a quite, I don't say intelligent way to drive, but it was quite technical to survive the car and win that championship.
One thing that's so noticeable about seeing that car out there today, and some of the others too, is that they're all so beautiful to look at, and they're all so different from each other. And nowadays, if you painted them all black, you couldn't tell one from the other, could you?
Well, I don't like to talk about those time and this time now. And it's very, it's. I think, yeah, you don't know how much I love to drive the car with the clutch and change the gears, and it's so good. It's really amazing how much I enjoy. I still have these funny cars with the pedals and all automatic and these, and that's very nice. But doesn't give you a pleasure to drive, like change the gears and have the power and have no power control and all these things. You know, it can slide and I still enjoy a lot this kind of cars.
Which was the car you loved the best? Was it the BT49 or?
Look, the BT49. Was the easiest car to drive. Was bloody quick in the corner and was no power at all, you know. But this one here is the most difficult, and you have to careful to keep the car in one piece. You know?
Well, I mean, Gordon always said that he essentially designed a dragster, you know, but or everything at the back of the car, and it was just a.
Yeah, the car was. They put all the radiator, everything come to the back, and the engine is quite small. You know? It was this 1.5 liters four cylinder engine. It was the block was from the road car. You know, it's amazing.
What I mean, I heard so many different figures about the sort of horsepower you had in qualifying, and somebody I remember in the team was saying, I remember it might have been Herbie, saying almost 1500 in qualifying.
Look, no? The truth is. The true Paul Rocha doesn't know, because the Dyna, the Dyna go to 1,250, and that was getting nearly 2,000 revs below. Before that was getting that, and they didn't know exactly what the power have, usually you have two set of tires for qualifying. We put about 5 bar boost and do the qualifying, and we've done a very good time already. And the next one, he closed the weight gauge complete and go 5.5, 5.6, 5.7, depends of the weather, bar. And he's still doing one more lap, but he never know what power he had. I know we got, every time we got between 35 kilometers quicker in the straight. We have to put fourth, fifth, and sixth gear 3 points longer now to get in the end of the straight. And that was the point. And it was very difficult to qualify because first, we have one tire, two set of tires. Sometimes we did three laps. We get all the user do another time. But it's only for fun because the time was already, we already in pole position those time, and have this so much power, you know, to get in the corner. It's and only one lap. It's not to don't get used to. Have to do it, you know. That was the point. Yeah.
When you arrived, you described this as a museum. Have you met any other relics from your day since you've been here?
Yeah, I saw some friends. Some drivers, I look at this, like, let me look in the mirror. Do I'm bad like him? I'm getting bad like that?
Have you seen Ricardo?
No, not yet.
No?
I don't think he can.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Hika was there, but I didn't see him.
Ah, oh, okay.
I saw Chief Nudel. I said, Jesus, you're getting old. Jesus, do I look like you, old like that?
The thing is, man, you're a legend.
Yeah.
Talking of legends, because we have so little time, let me ask you straight out: who would you say was your toughest competitor when you were winning those titles? The guy that you really thought, you know, I've got to do something good.
Look. My situation was different. Usually, I have a tough driver driving together with me at Williams, Nigel. But Nigel was very, very lucky because the first year I have a couple of engine failure. I could win the championship very easy. The second year, I knocked my head down in Imola, and I lost the dippiness. And I didn't told nobody because they couldn't. Because if you tell, they don't let me race. And I keep running behind Nigel all races. You know, he was my I would say, yeah. And he was unlucky because he lost to Nothing Wheel and this. And in the end, I won the championship. But that was my most difficult year because I was not right. You know.
When were you right? How long did it take before you were back to normal?
Well, it took a long time. I think by the last races I was quite good, but it took a long time to see properly. I was doing every 2 weeks I go to the doctor, and he said, oh, it's still bad, still bad. They said, what I do? He said, nothing, it's coming slowly. No.
Are you telling us that you never told anybody about that?
No, I only told in the year. No, only in the end of the
Right, now we're going to sit down, Emerson. Nice to see you. Wow, okay, this is Brazil time.
Yeah.
Yay. Okay, welcome, Emerson. Thank you very much for coming. What? Do you want to tell us some lies as well?
I don't tell any lies.
If he tells more lies, he knows it's going to be even bigger. Like a Pinocchio.
Emerson.
You're lying.
20th anniversary of the Goodwood Festival of Speed. Tell us what you're doing here this weekend, please.
I'm enjoying. I'm having fun. First thing. I'll be driving the JPS again. I'm driving the Lotus Jump Play Special, but I always have fun, always something new. Yesterday, for the first time, I saw all the record break car from the Daytona Museum. They are fantastic. I only saw in pictures and film, and I don't know who are the crazy guys that go and drive that things.
They're wonderful, aren't they? They really are.
Oh, wonderful cars.
Nelson was just telling us that when he tested the Brabham at Thorny Island Airfield on Thursday, he was very, very shocked by the power, and he thought, my God, what am I doing here? Do you relate to that kind of feeling now when you get back in these cars?
Well, I'm sure that car, how much power has? 1,200?
No, here, I think, I don't think maybe he has 600, 700 horsepower, but it's already enough to make me faint.
You told me once, you said it's like being back with an old girlfriend.
Yes. Well, I think it's always great to be back here on our original car. I don't know if Nelson feels that. Even the smell inside is the same, you know? Did you smell inside the cockpit?
Yeah, the smell changed because we shit ourselves and the smell come up. You know?
Okay. This is a great celebration for Brazil right now, right here at Goodwood, isn't it? I mean, with you two guys here. Are we going to see a return of... Are there some great Brazilians coming? I know there's your grandson, isn't there? I mean, that would be nice to happen again, wouldn't it? Because it's been a bit of a...
Well, more racing in Brazil is lost a lot, you know. We don't have a base category, and... It's getting difficult, huh? It's getting difficult to get a new drivers up there. But
Missing. Tell us about your grandson. He's doing rather well, isn't he?
Well, we know it's a long way to go to Formula One. He's doing well. He just come. He started NASCAR.
Yeah.
He's used to drive an oval, and actually he's testing today in Brands Hatch, as we speak.
Did you not do a few laps with him in a NASCAR car, and he was way quicker than you, wasn't he?
He was easy quicker than the grandfather. That was a lot of fun.
Anybody can be quicker than him.
See, Nelson.
You're not competitive anymore, are you, Nelson?
No, at all, no.
Nelson.
Yeah, we
never
know
competitive.
Actually, Emerson had better luck at India than you did, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Short. But I went there to do one race.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know. But it amazed me. I was there in 93 when you did the second one.
Yeah.
And it amazed me after you ever went back. Sure.
Have you heard, you've heard about this new film about James Hunt and Niki Lauda? Will either of you interested in seeing that?
Oh, yeah, I am. Yeah, I would like to see it very much, yeah.
It's a special era of Formula One.
Yeah.
I think it's different from now. It's good to see. Good for the public to know what was going on.
We need some more big characters, don't we, really? I mean, you guys were... I mean, you were serious, of course, world champions, but you had some fun, didn't you? I know you did. And nowadays it all seems terribly, terribly serious and, you know, am I right? What do you think?
I think they cannot say or they don't want to say what they think and what they do. They have to say what the PR guy wants him to say. It's not what his emotion, what his challenge, his personality is not there. I mean, it's very sad to see the interviews now. They cannot express exactly what's going on. We don't know. You look at the drivers now, they like on a computer program.
Huh? Well, I tell you something I remember, Nelson, which could absolutely not happen now. In Austria, in 85, at the end of qualifying, Alan Henry and I had been out on the circuit watching. We came back into the paddock, and you were in a caravan in the paddock. And we were passing, and you tapped on the window and said, so we came and sat down, and we spent an hour with you, and what you were trying to decide at that time was whether to stay with Bernie or whether to go to Frank.
Mm.
And you wanted our opinions. I mean, that's so far removed from how it is now.
Yeah.
Because I remember you saying, you know, what you had to say about how much or how little Bernie paid you and what Frank was offering and everything else. But that something like that is simply impossible now.
Yeah, and I signed a contract with Frank in a car park. We signed a contract with 19 items, and he signed, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay, I think you have to go, Emerson. But I just want to ask you one more quick thing. When you drive here at the festival, can you just tell me what it feels like? Because the you can almost feel the love of the crowd for you guys. You can almost feel it, can't you?
Well, I think you can see the enthusiasm of the people, and I'm sure the enthusiasm of ourselves to see when we are here in the driver's lounge to see four generations of different drivers.
He calls it a museum.
But you have the young guys too.
We are a museum already.
We are the museum because you have the young guys. I mean, when I see Stirling Moss here, you know, my memory goes back to, you know, so many years. It's fantastic to see Stirling Moss driving today. I mean, I saw him in the Mercedes today. And that's part of the history of motor race.
He's only 83, Emerson.
We'll be here.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Nelson and us, we promise now be here 83, 84 years old. Nelson, what do you think? Are you going to be here with me?
Not a sitting in a racing car, maybe in a wheelchair.
Nelson doesn't look very happy about being
Nelson
83,
looks good,
by the way.
He'll be here, 83, 84, running. We'll be back in good mood for the 40th anniversary.
I hope we're
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the challenge, huh? Nelson,
Emerson,
I invite you. 40 years of good.
You will be
here both.
You will be 86.
86 and you, Nelson, yeah. 85. He's only 1 year old, younger than me.
Come on. He's still alive, yeah? See? You see why, huh? You understand why, huh?
Thank you very much. The editor has finally arrived. Kind of you to turn up, Mr. Smith.
I'm sorry I was late. I was with Michael Bock of Mercedes-Benz Classic, and I wanted to ask him about the auction this afternoon of the Fangio W196, because he was telling me that they've got nearly 900 cars in Stuttgart, classic Mercedes-Benz racing cars, which is quite an amazing number. And I wanted to know if he's going to add to that number this afternoon. But he told me very firmly that he won't be, because they don't have the money, apparently, to bid for the car this afternoon. He's expecting a record number. Obviously, this podcast will be going out after the auction, so you'll all know how much it went for. But he was also admitted he was slightly unhappy that the car is coming up for sale at all, because it was actually loaned to Bewley many years ago, and they sold it on. So, but it's the one thing that I think today everyone is talking about is the Mercedes and how much it's going to sell for.
Just explain for those who don't know exactly what we're talking about here. You know, what is being sold in about an hour's time.
So it's the ex Fangio 1954 German Grand Prix winning W196. So a very, very special car, which is basically in untouched condition since its last race, which was Monza 55, and it's incredible condition. We had a look at it last night. I was lucky enough to be here for the ball last night, and it's just fabulous, and it doesn't need restoring. Maybe the internals to get the engine running, but the bodywork shouldn't be touched, because it's fabulous.
No, I mean that adds to it, I think, that it hasn't been restored and it's just as it last race.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, this is almost an undiscovered Rembrandt, isn't it?
Yeah, it's had a very interesting, colourful life, as Damien says. It's,
yes, it certainly has.
But I'll tell you what, though, that, you know, Mercedes have got you remember the famous streamlined one-car transporter that they used in 55, which could do over 100 miles an hour with a car on the back? That's here.
Yes.
And I wondered, well, have they just brought it over so they can drive it straight back to Germany when they've bought it?
That's what I wondered, but he assured me earlier on that there's no way they're going to bid for it, and he said we've already got six of them, so we don't need another one. He said it is a very important car, but we don't need another one, so there you go. But I was quite surprised. I thought Mercedes would want to, you know, complete the set, but I guess it's probably quite hard for them to buy something which they don't feel should be, you know, should have been sold in the first place.
That was a very nice way of putting it, actually.
Damien, here we are in the Black Rock Drivers Club on the 20th anniversary of the Goodwood Festival of Speed. I asked the same question to Nigel earlier on, but what is it for you that is so gripping about this event? You know, what is it that brings us back year after year after year?
Well, there's two things. The cars and the drivers, essentially. I mean, it's the only place where you can see Nelson Piquet these days, you know, and Emerson Fittipaldi sitting together. Just seeing these old guys looking slightly older than they maybe did in their prime, but that's, you know, they enjoy it. You can see how much they enjoy it from their reaction to the crowd reaction. The appreciative audience here know what they're seeing is special, and the collection of cars is, you know, the revival. I love the revival because it's racing and it's at the circuit, but here the collection of cars all eras, that's what makes the festival special to me.
I must say it's a real privilege, isn't it, to be sitting here for an hour and have, you know, Nelson and Emerson here together joking and telling you know, great stories, aren't they, Nigel?
They actually don't seem greatly different to me from how they were when they were doing it. I think it's the world that's changed and they haven't.
Okay, well, let's move on to our next guest. And our next guest is a real treat. How do we know that? Because he was with us last year as well. Good man, John McGuinness. Welcome and thank you very much for coming. Damo, start us off.
John, congratulations on the 20th win. What did that mean to you to get to that mark? Must have been a lot.
It's not so much the 20, it's just winning races. You know, it was, this year at the TT, I was under a little bit of pressure, really. I had a new teammate, new kid on the block, Michael Dunlop, and he seemed to be just winning everything. And I had to carry some different colours in the first race. We did a Joey Dunlop tribute, which I'm feeling a little bit under pressure, a little bit at the start of the week. And, you know, but I just kept my head down and kept pushing and pushing. And, you know, I wasn't thinking about the tally of wins. I just wanted to win some races and do a good job. And to win the senior was, if you're going to pick a race to win, it's probably the senior you would like to win, you know. And it's a blue ribbon race. And, yeah, we got it, you know. It was a tough race, and it looked like it was a foregone conclusion that Michael was going to carry on and win the five. And, you know, everybody was saying, it's a changing of the guard, if you like, and there's a new king and one thing or another. So that was the whole thing, is just give me a little bit of inspiration, a little bit of passion and a bit of fire in my belly, and it was nice to get that win.
Sorry, I was going to say, it's almost nervous watching Michael, though, because he looked like he was on the ragged edge during those races.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose anybody running at the front of the race on the outside, it's always going to look pretty insane, really. You know, everybody thinks we're madmen anyway, but we do a skillful job. You know, I know there's a little element of madness in it, if you like, but it's still a hell of a thing to control. You know, and if you're doing it lap after lap after lap to be able to do it, you know, it shows that you are on the right lines and everything. But he's a little bit wild. He's a little bit raw. They've got loads of ability and balls, if you like, you know, there's no question. But it's all just coming together now. He's, you know, he's crossing the T's and dotting the I's, and he's in our team. It's not our, the Legends team. So he's come into a great team, and I've helped him out a little bit, you know. I've helped him maybe too much, you know. Maybe shouldn't have told him too many tips, but it's good to see. I can't see kids like, he's only 25-year-old, you forget, you know. And I did my first TT when I was 25 years old, and he's won 7 TTs at the age I started, so he's got an incredible future ahead of him with TT. So we'll see what the next few years bring.
It's not time for a new king yet, is it, John?
No, not at all. You know, it's I had the pace in the first race, but with the TT race now, when the flag drops, if you're a little bit lazy at the start and you drop 8-10 seconds, you're done. You know, you've got to be absolutely on lap record breaking pace from the drop of the flag, and the, you know, as you let go of that clutch, you've got to be bang on it. And you know, I was lazy at the start. I had a 60 second penalty in the pits. You know, I made a schoolboy error in the pits. You know, my team told me to stop, and I didn't they never had the cap shut, the fuel cap, and I rode off, so I had to take my hand off the speed limiter and do it myself. When I took the hand off the limiter, I speeded up, and you know, it was just a silly mistake, and I had to ride hard. But I broke the outright lap record on the last lap, which proves I still had the pace, and I just needed to take that to the senior, you know, the following Friday and start off at that pace, and we managed to win another one. So awesome.
John, I'm just interested, do you ever think about when you might stop, or is it something that you don't think of?
Yeah.
You think it'll just happen when it happens, or?
Yeah, I mean, I do think about it, and I it's amazing, you know. I'm sat around here, around this circle with you great people at 41 years old. I never thought I would be still winning races at 41, you know. I mean, when I was 20-year-old, I looked at a 40-year-old bloke, I thought he was an old codger, you know, and like now I'm 41, so I still feel good, you know. I still feel great. I look pretty average, but I feel brilliant. And when I get on the bike and just flick the helmet on and let the clutch out, I feel at one, I feel at home on the bike, and you know, the results are still coming, and I still have brilliant people working with me, fantastic mechanics, and also I get the full support from my family, the wife, and you know, my mum, my dad, they all still love it, and they don't put me under any pressure to stop. So at the moment, you know, that feeling when you win, it's the best feeling in the world, and it's hard to let go. And I speak to some of the racers who've retired, and you know, some of them are still in a bad spot. You know, they're still racers, and they find it difficult. You know, so I don't know what I'm going to do.
But you got Stuart Graham sitting there.
Well, he's got his leathers on from 1966, and if I get my leathers from 1996, I'll be over the moon. But a great ambassador for the sport, obviously, Stuart. You know, amazing family, and done some amazing things in racing. You know, you read the old books, and Stuart's in there winning races at the TT. But you know, I'm going to be like this chap, aren't I? When I retire, I'm going to be here and telling everybody how fast I used to be.
Don't forget, he's won the TT on four wheels as well.
Well,
you haven't done that yet.
There's always time, you know. I mean, I've been looking at a few cars. I've only got a little seat, so not that I'm getting my fat ass in some of them cars. But I had a test in one of those aerial atom things. Is it an aerial atom? I had a test in one of those, and that scared me. So I don't know. It's not as easy as it looks, car racing. It looks easy from the outside, but it's a damn sight harder when you actually get behind the wheel.
Excuse me, did you say it scared you?
Yes, it did. It did. It scared me, yeah.
The aerial atom scared you.
Well, I was on the TT course, actually, racing it against my bike, and I went around the bungalow and just put my foot down on it in it, and it just went sideways, snapped sideways, and I thought I was going to go down the train line back down towards Laxey in the Isle of Man in the car. But I was out of my comfort zone a little bit. But big respect for the car drivers, you know, they do. It's not, they make it look easy, and obviously when you're in the cockpit, it's not easy at all.
Stuart Graham, thank you very much for coming along. Thank you.
Hey, you lovely bikers, to be here again.
You bikers are a different breed, aren't you? Really?
Well, so they tell us. You know, I mean, as John has proved, you know, he's still doing a great job. He claims to be old, of course. He's still only quite young, really.
He's only 41.
Yeah.
And that's when Michael Schumacher came back to Formula One.
Exactly.
So I don't see what the problem is, really,
yeah.
Do you?
Yeah. He's benefiting all that experience now. Yeah. Yeah, but no, John does a great job. And around the Isle of Man, he is the man. And I think he had us all a little bit stressed out this year, hoping that he'd manage to get this 20th, you know. But no, it was great. He did
a good
job.
It's the fact that it's unchanging, isn't it, Stuart? That's the point. It's still the same challenge it always was.
Well, it's exactly the same.
You know, they haven't put safer barriers up everywhere.
Well, it's just the same because, of course, the bikes are going quicker. The road obviously improves a bit. And, of course, well, that's part of the challenge of the island. Every time you go back, they've resurfaced a bit or done something else or eased a corner or something. So there's always something new to look at. But yeah, it is very much an institution, that place, and even when you see it, you think to run round here at this sort of speed is,
yeah, no,
frankly, a bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
Talking about road surfaces, Goodwood has put a new surface on a lot of the Festival of Speed hill. People are saying it's going to be 2 seconds quicker.
I wouldn't know. I've only been up on the bike once, and I was too busy trying to find out which gear I was supposed to be in. But we don't do speed. We just make a lot of noise on the bike.
That's okay. We like a lot of noise. That's absolutely fine.
Well, that's part of the deal.
Danny Sullivan.
Yeah, well, yeah.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, fantastic. It's always good to be back at Goodwood.
All the way from the United States.
Yes, sir.
What are you driving?
I'm driving the 86 Indy winning, Indy 500 winning March. I won in 85, but this was Ray Hall's car. So we're going to take it up the hill. And again, I heard everybody describing about 2 seconds faster in lap times. I think this one probably still has a locker in it and probably the Indy gears. So I might not get out of second gear. But it'll be interesting. It's always fun. And just to walk around here and look at the cars and bikes and the people and, you know, seeing Stuart and see Kenny Roberts sat down over there and, you know, just all the heroes. Nelson Piquet, who I raced at Le Mans with and was in for him. It's just a great gathering of people and cars. Fabulous event.
Well, Danny and I were just talking earlier about it, and of course part of the challenge is running some of these older vehicles, which have probably happily been lying in a museum somewhere. And, you know, they look lovely and they sound okay, but then you get halfway up the hill and you think, I wonder when these brakes were last used and things like that, you know. So it can be a whole new challenge.
And who looked after them is a big factor, you know. You don't want to it's not exactly, but even the some of the good cars have gone off, and so you just, it's a demonstration. And the fast cars like Rod Millen and his Pikes Peak truck and the Formula One car, that's a different deal. These are old technology. They're not even if we had them the best we possibly could, we're still going to be 8, 10, 15 seconds slower than those guys.
Have either of you seen the film of Loeb going up Pikes Peak?
I haven't seen it. Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't watch it.
You really should, Stuart. I mean, it genuinely is mind blowing, isn't it?
But you know, even Loeb said, you know, it scared him.
Yeah.
I mean, I've raced.
I'm glad he did, because if it didn't, I would worry about it.
I've raced against up Pikes Peak, and just once. But let me tell you something. It's like, you just go for the horizon, and then when the peak one, this is just a peak off the side. When you see the peak, take a left, and it's like, oh great, that sounds really comforting as you're in, you know, flat on the throttle.
So how much practice you get on it?
They do the first practice is the bottom half of the mountain. You get two, and if you're lucky, three runs. And then the second time you do the top half, two or three runs, and then you start.
And then
that's
you do it.
Sounds a bit like the Isle of Man. You've got to go for 10 years before you know where you're going.
But it presumably it's now paved.
I was going to say it would have been dirt when you did it.
It was about a third paved and two thirds dirt when I did it. And you know, I mean, it's a great experience, but you can see, like, and I think Stuart, you and I were discussing a little bit this. You got to be careful when you do these kind of special one-off demonstrate, because you're not as focused, you're not as doing, and that's when the stuff can go wrong.
But in times gone by, it was a round of the USAC Championship.
Absolutely.
And Mario won it in the same car he won Indy with.
Right.
Can you imagine a turbocharged Indy car?
No. In dirt.
No, absolutely. In dirt. Yeah.
And the answers, and Bobby's here. Bobby was one of the kings of Pikes Peak. The Unsers dominated Pikes Peak. You know, the family did for a long, long time.
Well, I heard a great story that they don't chop any trees down higher up, because you know, if somebody goes off the edge, you've got to have something to land in, you know.
Yeah, but you're high enough that you're actually above tree line.
Is that right?
For half of it, for the top half.
It's all a decent distance then.
Well, finish at 13,200 or 600 feet. I mean, it's...
I remember Mario saying, you know, some corners there'd be sort of bushes at the exit, and he said, you know, you really hung it out through those because you felt safe, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Bushes, wow.
Yeah.
But
a special event, and I think that you know, when you see how Loeb and those guys did it and Peugeot did it, you know, with the, you know, staff of 30 and the testing and stuff like that, but... as is the case with most European manufacturers, that is how they would go about it. And he did a lot of hill climb. And that car, I don't know if you saw any of the road test stuff on that car, but phenomenal.
It's a big car, actually.
Well,
enormous,
it's wide,
width,
but it's...
It looks very wide.
But so much horsepower. Yeah. But, you know, go take a look. Right here at Goodwood, Rod Millen's truck, pickup truck, arguably it's a, you know... It's a pickup truck, but you know, think about that. That thing's got 1,100 horsepower, all-wheel drive, you know, special chassis, everything like that. And of course, Rod built it, and Rod's a fantastic driver, great rally driver, anyway. So he, you know, it suits him. But you know, that's what you've got to get to set a record up that place. So anyway,
can we change the subject just with you, Stuart, for a minute, because we're seeing Cal Crutchlow doing pretty well at the moment, aren't we? Something that interests me about Cal Crutchlow and MotoGP is when he doesn't fall off, he's right there. I mean, he's going to win one, isn't he? But he does crash quite a bit. I mean, this is a fact. So is that something that all a top rider's just got to put behind him? How does that go?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, we've seen it both on four wheels and two wheels many times where a guy's extremely quick, but then he falls off a lot or makes mistakes. Sometimes they sort of gradually grow out of it or learn. Other times they don't. So, of course, it's a very tricky one to predict, really. And I think the difficulty now, certainly on a lot of these things, everything's so evenly matched. there's split seconds in it. So it's very, very close and highly competitive. And I think in Cal's case, from what I can maybe understand, he's not on a full works bike. So, of course, he's having to make up that little bit extra. But the hope is, of course, that he just manages to sort of maybe calm down a little occasionally and get that consistency. Because ultimately, whatever you're trying to do, that's the secret. You've got to be very, very quick, but you've also got to be consistent.
As a layman, let me ask you a question, though. Sorry to be the interviewer on this, but in that deal, because Marquez, is that, I'm not saying it correctly, I mean, he's fantastic, but he falls off as well. How much of it is the new bikes, the new technology, the tires? Is any of that a factor?
Well, I think the technology, which still baffles me, I have to say, and we were talking about this earlier, that I think the angles of lean that they've got now and the sort of the way these modern circuits are and the whole modern style is that you just scratch and scratch until suddenly you fall off the thing and you think, oh, fine, I'll back off a bit now. And I did joke once a year or two back with these young guys that crashing was almost part of the setup routine, you know. Yeah. So I don't really know. I find it very strange, but I think, you know, they're at such extreme angles that the difference between the tyre holding on, because the suspension doesn't get a chance to do an awful lot of work. So it's a very fine line, but again, we old guys go back to the time when the last thing you want to do is crash because you were either going to hit a tree or a wall or something.
Well, and you didn't have airbag.
And we didn't have
levers.
We didn't have the extreme levels of grip. But of course, that also can lead you into trouble. And again, a bit like ground effect cars. And if something does let go, then yeah, you're in trouble. But everything's relative to the speed and the grip and the power and the surroundings. I think the surroundings make a difference. You know, if we knew we'd got 100 yards of runoff area, then it's amazing how brave you can be. You know?
Well, it's true. Even in Formula One, when they came to Indy and they had that extra area down there at the end of the straightaway, they were all trying it because the most they were going to do is run across the grass and back onto the track. And everybody said, it was a great spot to try to pass, but there wasn't a fault. There wasn't a penalty, except maybe screwing up your tires a little bit, but you weren't gonna wad it up. And as racing has gotten, there's always been a lot at stake.
But
now with the manufacturers involved, the money involved, the sponsors involved, how important for the teams, the money that's involved, the more points you score, all that sort of stuff, you take away some of that.
Yeah, I think you've got to have a little bit of spot, and sometimes I think we've got so much runoff area now, the next thing will be directional signs back to the circuit, you know, so that the guy doesn't actually get lost, you know.
You laugh, but the Salt Lake track at Miller Motorsports Park in Salt Lake City, who was it? One of the English sports car drivers, and he spun, and it was dirt, and he spun out there, and it does kind of. And he said he had to wait until a couple cars came by to know which way to go, whether it was left or right.
I can believe it.
It was so featureless.
Different discipline.
There's no feature to it.
Yeah.
You know?
And they might reintroduce scenery and trees. You never know. It's a new challenge.
Or do it all through virtual.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so they can't hit it.
Well, the danger is that we mustn't, I know it sounds awful, but we mustn't remove the danger element because, frankly, that somehow gets
I think
what
we all agree
spot,
with that.
You know?
I think,
where do you draw the line?
Those of us who don't take part definitely agree with that.
Well, that's true.
What was the young chap's name that we were talking to, the 1-5?
Ian Hutchinson.
Ian Hutchinson. Yeah. And he said, of all things, you know, all the TTs, all the time, and he goes and falls down at Silverstone in the wet and gets run over and
smashes his leg to pieces.
It can even
happen anywhere.
So it can happen anywhere. You know, Silverstone's one of the safest tracks there is, okay, and yet it happens. So I don't think that we're ever going to be in danger of removing the danger aspect of motorsports. Look at Le Mans in an Aston Martin. You would have never thought you couldn't have predicted that ever, you know. And it's still racing, still motorsports. Stuff's going to happen.
Well, any good thing, Danny, is I still believe that four wheels are better than two. From the safety point of view.
I'm not arguing with you.
You are qualified to say that, actually.
Well, that's one of my...
I wouldn't disagree.
Benefit of experience.
Okay, let's end on Goodwood, shall we? Because we're in the Black Rock Drivers Club 20th anniversary. I think we're all agreed it's an absolutely phenomenal event.
It's the best event in the world, and we've always said that. And I often find myself saying it, and again, Danny will agree with me on this, that. And I'm a lot older, I have to say, but I always sort of slightly say that if it hadn't been for Lord March with creating this sort of event, you know, old people like myself would have long since been sort of consigned to the history bin and not doing anything, the same activity. So to do here and the revival, you know, it provides my sort of fix for the year, which is absolutely lovely. And the whole thing's done in such terrific style. And, yeah, we're so well looked after. And of course, it's the best social event of the year, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't have met Stuart if it hadn't have been for this event, because we were seated one night at a table. And so you've made a lot of extra friends, and you get to see people. I have Nelson Piquet, who I shared a car with at Le Mans. I haven't seen Nelson for years. And, you know, so you kind of get to rekindle friendships. You make new ones. Plus, yesterday I came here, there was only about 25 or 30,000 people walking around. Think, well, I'll sneak out and go look at all the cars and the different things, which I did. And are they what are the Blue Arrows? What's the big land speed cars? All the
Bluebird.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I kept calling them Blue Arrows. I mean, but anyway, the Bluebirds all over there, and even some of the rat rods, and the guys were out doing all the tricks on the motorcycles.
Yeah, that is brilliant. That is brilliant.
You know, it's just for us guys.
Wall to wall entertainment.
Wall to wall, and it's for us.
Pity we haven't got time to see it all.
No, you cannot in 3 days.
You can't see it.
With your other duties, you can't get to every paddock and see every car and everything that's going on.
Well, welcome back. And thank you very much for joining us. Great to see you guys.
Well, we're looking for a good weekend.
You make the weekend for us. Yeah. Well done. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Our final guest on our podcast today, which has gone far, far too quickly for my liking, is Vic Elford. Thank you for coming, Vic.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you.
You've driven a few Porsches in your time, Vic.
Yeah, quite a few.
What's it like seeing all those cars together? Because it's quite a collection, isn't it?
Well, it is quite a collection. It's very nice as well today, because I'm driving the 1967 911 that is actually doing a world tour. And that brings back a lot of memories, because, you know, back at the end of 1966, Porsche wasn't interested in racing with the 911, and I had to drag them into it, which worked pretty well. And so all the way through 1967, I drove a variety of 911s, mostly with success, and it's always been always had a very soft spot for me, the very early 911s, especially the short wheelbase one that nobody wanted to drive because it was too dangerous. In fact, it was the most marvelous car.
But a bit of danger never bothered you that much, did it?
Well, it wasn't dangerous. No, the problem, I think, with the early 911s was that one or two people said, you can't drive it, it's undrivable. In fact, it wasn't at all. It was a lovely, forgiving car. You just had to learn how to treat it.
If I'm remembering right, when you started running the red 911, didn't a lot of the touring car guys get very snotty about whether it was eligible to compete against, you know, Lotus Cortinas and the like?
You mean in the British Touring Car Championship?
Yeah, I seem to remember you getting quite a lot of trouble with that.
Well, not really trouble, but I wasn't too popular. Because there were basically two 911s. There was a short wheelbase 911 that I turned into a rally car and won rallies and championship with. And then after that, I'm sure you remember the Lyddon Hill Rallycross with the car straight out of the Aldington showrooms that I won with. That was the one that became the race car, because it was too dented to sell it. It was classified, I'm not sure if it was homologated or simply accepted, whatever they did in those days, but it was classified as a touring car, because if you remember, in those days there were the two seats for the driver and passenger, and then in the back there were two seats for legless children, and they qualified as seats even though they were for legless children. And so it was a four-seater and did indeed qualify for the championship, which we went on to win.
Next year, Porsche are going back to Le Mans. Now, Porsche obviously have this amazing heritage at Le Mans. It's very exciting to see them back in LMP1. They've taken on some Grand Prix driver to drive for them next year. In your day, drivers used to switch between F1 and sports cars all the time. What do you think it's like these days for someone like Mark Webber going into that car?
Well, it's obviously totally changed. You know, everything about it has changed. First of all, we didn't get paid very much. So if we could do a second series, that was nice because we would make a little bit more money because none of us finished up by being rich at the end of those days. In Mark's case, I don't know him, but actually I met him once here, probably about 6 years ago. And what little I saw of him, I liked him, got on with him. He's obviously not just a highly professional guy, but he obviously still wants to go on racing and winning. And I think having been shown the door at Red Bull, and I'm sure he was shown the door, he's made a very good choice, because who better to drive for than Porsche if you want to go sports car racing?
Would you fancy a go in that new car? Would you fancy a go in that new car?
Yes, I would and I wouldn't. I mean, I've always wanted to drive new cars or different cars. When I was much younger, there was one car that I always had wanted to drive, and that was a D-Type Jaguar. I never got the opportunity. Now I'm probably a bit too old to be able to drive it and enjoy it. Today there is one car that I would have just loved to have driven as well. Actually, there are two now, but one is the whichever is the latest Audi, you know, the R18 or the e-tron or whatever. I wouldn't sit for it now, but I would love to have had the opportunity to drive that. And now there's a third one on my list. It's called a Peugeot with 875 kilos and 875 horsepower to go with it. I mean, I don't know, Loeb. I've never met him. I'd love to someday.
We're just talking about it. Have you seen? You presumably seen the movie of him going up Pikes Peak?
Yeah, I saw it on.
I mean, it's.
I saw it a couple of weeks ago.
Were you as impressed as we were?
Well, yeah, except that I could see myself doing it as well, 40 years ago. Yeah, but the car is obviously phenomenal. He obviously. I think he's probably like me. He's got a phenomenal memory for roads, because I've never been up Pikes Peak, but I knew the Monvo 2 hill climb, which is the same. You know, you make a mistake, you go downhill for 5,000 feet. So I would like to have done that, and I'd like to meet him sometime.
Yeah, the only thing was, it's a shame it wasn't on dirt, and it was on tarmac. It's a shame that it wasn't on dirt.
I think it's very impressive on tarmac. Yeah. Had it been the old one 20 years ago, that would have been impressive too.
Yeah.
Remember when Michel Moudon beat everybody, and Robbie Unser at the top was making a fuss of it. And she said, well, you know, what do you want to get? You want to race down too?
Thank you very much, Vic. Vic Elford.
My pleasure.
It's a real pleasure, as ever. You're a great guy. Thank you very much for coming along.
Thank you.
I wish we could talk to you for longer, but have a wonderful festival.
I'll come back tomorrow.
Have a wonderful festival speech.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Okay, that brings us to the end, I'm afraid. Time's gone rather quickly, but we are at the end of another Motorsport Magazine podcast. And it's goodbye from the Black Rock Drivers Club at the Goodwood Festival Speed. But before we go, let me remind you of a very special reader event that's coming up in September, a couple of months' time, in fact. We will be having a barbecue evening with Sir Stirling Moss at the Hurlingham Club in London on September the 18th. That's September the 18th. Now, this will give you a three-course dinner with drinks all evening. So come and join us and Sir Stirling Moss at a barbecue at the Hurlingham Club in London on September the 18th. If you are a subscriber, the price for this is £110. If you're not a subscriber, it is £118. It will be a great night, and I do hope that lots and lots of you can come. Meanwhile, it's goodbye from Goodwood, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.